and welcome to another episode of The Right Side. I'm Andrew Ruth, and I'm here as ever with my co-host Kimberly Ross. How are you?
I'm wonderful this morning, especially since I just got some coffee. How are you?
I have not had coffee, and it is 8 a.m. on the West Coast, so I am looking forward to that after our conversation with our guest, who is National Review's Alexandra DeSantis. How are you? Thank you for being here, Alexandra.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. So I just want to start off by saying, like, I follow Alexandra. I think you follow me back on Twitter, and you suffer from a similar affliction that I suffer from as having the name Andrea, is that but different in that people at least spell my name right. The most hilarious thing that I've ever seen is the consistency with which people spell your name wrong and probably pronounce it wrong as well, with Alexandria, which is a city in Egypt, not your name.
All the time. Yeah, I get Alexandria. I get a lot of just people assuming I go by Alex, which I go by Zan. It's a little bit odd with an X. I get Alexander even sometimes, Alexa, Alexis. So,
Yeah, it doesn't help that we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because the other day I was like, shouldn't we have Alexandria? No, wait, that's not. It's Alexandra DeSantis. I mean, yeah, because it's bothering me, this uninformed socialist. I mean, it's you and her completely opposite, so I shouldn't get you too confused.
It definitely has. The instances of this have gone up since she came onto the
scene.
Oh, poor you. So we have more serious and heavier topics. So I wanted to start the show with just the absurd with your name. And if I at any time say your name incorrectly, I sincerely apologize, because I know how that feels, being an Andrea and not an Andrea or an Andrea or any of the variants of that. Kim, do you want to go ahead and start?
Oh, sure, definitely. Yeah, today, as we mentioned yesterday and perhaps the day before, today we're talking with Alexandra, and we're going to discuss the Catholic Church in light of the grand jury report that just came out last week. And also a little bit later, we're going to discuss the failure of the GOP to properly address the defunding of Planned Parenthood, which is something that continues to go on. We're told it's going to be taken care of, and there's nothing to show for it. It's pretty frustrating. And of course, you may know that Rand Paul had the amendment that did not pass on Thursday. So we're going to discuss that a little bit too. But the first thing, of course, we wanted to discuss was the Catholic Church and the scandal. And Alexandra is Catholic, and she's been pretty vocal about this on Twitter and elsewhere. And I really wanted to get her, we both wanted to really get her perspective. I'm not Catholic, so looking at it from an outsider's perspective is, fine, but it's great to get an insider's perspective as someone who obviously speaks up for the innocent, whether they're, in the womb. She's very vocal about the pro-life issue, or just, children in the church who have been victims of the sex abuse in the past. So I guess one of the first questions I would have for you, Alexandra, is, of course, you're aware that there are 300 priests that were named in this report, and there were 1,000 or more victims. And this was, I believe, in the past seven decades or something in the six dioceses in Pennsylvania. But the frustration I know a lot of people have, whether they're in the Catholic Church or not, is that this isn't the first time that we've heard about this. We've heard of, other incidents in Boston and elsewhere where priests have been, predatory towards the children that they're supposed to take care of and, supposed to teach lovingly about God's grace and sacrifice and all of that stuff. So I would just first ask you, what are your thoughts as someone who's in the church, who's a very strong Catholic and who obviously wants to see this kind of thing erased from, the current, what's going on in the church right now. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, the reports that we saw a couple weeks ago are just absolutely heartbreaking. And I think, I'm 23, so I don't really have a very strong memory of the last time an abuse scandal like this broke. What happened in Massachusetts in the early 2000s, a lot of this similar stuff came out, nowhere near as big in scale as what we learned about Pennsylvania. But I was just a kid, and so that didn't affect me viscerally in the way it affected a lot of Catholics and people outside the church, and changed the way that people saw the church. So I guess I kind of heard a little bit of the whispers from my parents and things, but obviously it didn't hit me at all as a child the way this one did. And so I kind of grew up and I learned more about it as I got older, and it was obviously extremely disturbing, but nothing like sort of the visceral effect that this had, being an adult Catholic and hearing about something this horrifying. And I think the worst thing about obviously reading the fact that this all happened was heartbreaking and terrible to think that people within my church were treating children this way. But on top of that, the fact that so much of it was covered up and handled improperly and brushed under the rug by people in charge was obviously not worse than what happened, but it was just a different kind of terrible, I guess. And that was a gut punch to see that not only were there evil people within my church doing this, but that people at the top level didn't take it seriously and didn't listen to the victims and didn't try to make it better. In some instances they did, but a lot of the time it was just swept under the rug. And so to me, my first thought after reading through a lot of this report, aside from just how heartbreaking it is, was where else has this happened and who else knew about it and didn't do anything?
Yeah, and I think I know people have said this in regards to the Pennsylvania grand jury report. Shouldn't other state attorneys general do a similar sort of thing in their state and look at anything that's been happening there? But that kind of idea or question, I guess, makes one think that this is perhaps more widespread than it actually is. And I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but do you think maybe something like that is necessary to, you know, root out any sort of other instances where this has occurred?
I do think so. I absolutely support that. And, you know, everybody that I've talked to, whether that's friends and family or just other Catholics in the media, people that I know, Catholic laity, and then on top of that, even some, you know, bishops or priests have written this and said this publicly. We absolutely have to have transparency and get all of these types of reports out in the public and come up with ways to make sure this never happens again. And, you know, hopefully, I hope and pray that if we did this in every state, we wouldn't see the types of reports that we saw out of Pennsylvania. I'm sure there would be something, you know, instances of things like this, because, you know, men are fallen and terrible things happen. But I'm hopeful it would be on this scale in other states. But even if it were, I think it's really important for the church and for people outside the church and the witness of the church, for this all to be out in the open and dealt with, and in a way that we can make sure it doesn't happen again somehow. And I don't know what that would look like, but I've seen a lot of ideas floated, and I think we have to talk about this because it totally compromises the moral witness of the church. And I still believe 100% in the teachings of my church, and this is evil people within my church just betraying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how was the response? It seemed like there was a variation of responses. I know Mike Glenn at the Houston Chronicle was very disappointed that his priest didn't discuss any of it, you know, at Mass when he was there. But you had a great series on Twitter about how your priest did address it. So what was your experience of the church's response? And I know the Pope at some point finally put out a statement. Just go into that a little bit. Like, what was your expectation and was that met, I guess, when you were actually at Mass and in the church and speaking to your...
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it varied a little bit depending on the day. So the day after the report came out, I went to Mass in the Archdiocese of Washington because I was in town. So I live in New York, but was in visiting my family in Virginia. And so I went to church. It was a holy day of obligation in D.C. And I was pretty disappointed with the response there. You know, the priest just said, you know, I wish we didn't have to be talking about this, and you all look kind of glum out there, and directed people to this PR website that the Archdiocese had set up to protect Cardinal Worrell, or to, you know, kind of clean up his reputation in light of the fact that he had been mentioned in this Pennsylvania report. So that was really disheartening, and I know a lot of people felt similarly about that in the Archdiocese of Washington and just wanted the Cardinal to be more straightforward with people and actually address the substance of the report. But then over the weekend, I was in the Diocese of Arlington, which is in Virginia, and my pastor there at my family's parish was, you know, did everything that I would have expected and was did exactly what I think a priest ought to do in this context. You know, he preached a whole homily about the gospel and about the Eucharist, which that's the focus of our faith. That's still the focus now. Mm-hmm. But then he did shy away from the report at all. He said, "We've seen horrible things. You're angry and hurt. I am too. You have every right to be." You know, he didn't say, you know, kind of drift around it or use euphemisms or talk about it vaguely. He addressed it head on and said, you know, these things are evil. They do not belong in our church. We have to hold our bishops accountable. Every single bishop should be doing something about this, talking about this, write to them, tell them how you feel and what you think. He talked a little bit about, you know, the history of what had happened in our diocese, that there hadn't been reports, and I'm not sure if that's true. That's just what he said, and I appreciated him addressing that. And then he just closed by saying, this is not our faith, and our faith is still exactly what we believed it to be before these reports came out, and we can't let this tarnish what we believe to be true. And so I thought that was really heartening, and having heard from other Catholics and talked to people around the country or just seeing things on Twitter, I think everybody that I've talked to in the laity felt very strongly that they wanted a response like that from their priest, and not everybody got it. And not every bishop wrote a letter about it. And some wrote great, great letters. The cardinal or the, Morlino in Madison, Wisconsin wrote a great letter as one example. There are a few great letters across the country really addressing this head on. But in other places, I think priests and bishops really haven't addressed it the way it needs to be. And I'd like to see a more unified response from the church.
Yeah. One of my favorite, oh, I'm sorry, Andrew.
Go ahead, Kim.
One of my favorite op-eds this past week was Hugh Hewitt wrote one for the Washington Post. And he, at the very top of the piece, is called The Con Man in the Cardinal's Cap. And the whole article is who you were talking about, Cardinal Worrell, and how I believe that he was mentioned more than 200 times in the grand jury report, and yet he's still in his position, you know, going about things as normal. And Hugh Hewitt he just blasts the people who are responsible for keeping Cardinal Worrell there. I'm not a part of the Catholic Church, so I'm not exactly sure what that all entails, but he is essentially saying, you know, if there needs to be, if we're really going to take care of things, Cardinal Worrell absolutely needs to be gone. He knew what happened. He, you know, in some of these cases, and he helped people cover up with non-disclosure agreements and things like this. And at the very end of his piece, Hugh Hewitt says, every day that Worrell continues in his job injures every victim and every Catholic. He undermined all the work of reform that went before him. He conned his colleagues. He conned the review board by avoiding its glaze. The con man should be gone this week. And of course, I don't believe he's gone, and I'm not sure if that's going to happen in the future, but as someone who, you know, sits in church and hears and believes these teachings, and I'm a person of faith too, like I said, not Catholic though, but it's frustrating because you don't have control over someone as high up as Cardinal Worrell, and he obviously has so much power and authority that he's still in his position, even though his name has been tainted by his connection to all of this. And it's frustrating to see, I mean, this man should be gone. Like, that's the first individual I would think that should be removed from his position. And I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but it should. And I know that you and Hugh Hewitt and others really believe that this is, I guess, the first step towards righting the wrongs as much as that could be done.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I was really glad to see that piece. And there have been a couple other op-eds from Catholic writers saying something similar and just trying to hold Cardinal Worrell accountable. And just to explain kind of the basics of how this would work, Cardinal Worrell is now 2 years over 75, so he's 77, and all cardinals, and I believe bishops too, have to submit their resignation to the Pope at the age of 75, and then the Pope can choose not to accept that resignation and allow them to continue serving if they're, you know, still young and doing a good job and whatever. And so the way this would work is Pope Francis could, at any point, could already have accepted Cardinal Worrell's resignation, whether that was a year ago because he just wanted to put a new guy in there, or now because of what was in this report, and he hasn't done that. And so I think the buck obviously stops with Pope Francis here, and people are very displeased that he would write a letter responding to this scandal and not take any kind of concrete action. I'm not sure what else we'll see from the Vatican. I, for one, have not been very pleased with the response. I think it's been largely very platitudinous and not very helpful, not full of anything substantive enough. But I do think that getting Cardinal Worrell out of his position would be a great start. And they have pointed out there were some cases in which the Cardinal did do what he was supposed to do when he was in Pittsburgh, and he did address some of these problems head on. But there were also a lot of cases where he didn't. And the fact that the Archdiocese and the Cardinal have responded by, you know, just pointing to the cases where he did things right and completely glossing over the others, or trying to make it seem as if they didn't happen, or putting out PR websites with the Archdiocese money to try and clean up his public image is disgusting to me, honestly. Yeah. I mean, that's what Catholics need right now. The Catholic Church needs at a moment like this is, I think it shows something really wrong with how our hierarchy operates.
Right, exactly. One of the other questions I have, and I've noticed this discussion as well, and it's an odd sort of question, but I think it's maybe one that needs to be asked, is people have mentioned perhaps the inclusion of, you know, gay priests into the Catholic Church. Is that why we're seeing you know, years of abuse, people who went into the faith and are taking this, you know, vow of celibacy and actually are gay, is that why we're seeing this? But of course, homosexuality doesn't mean pedophilia. Pedophilia is a different sort of, you know, sexual crime and urge that people have, whether they're straight or gay. So I don't know if this is something you've thought a lot about, but I've seen some people say, well, if they just get rid of gay priests and the problem will go away. Well, that's not necessarily true, because like I said, that doesn't mean pedophilia. And there were female victims as well. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm glad you brought that up. This is really, obviously a really, really tricky topic. And this is something I've seen floating around, and I don't like some of the rhetoric that I've seen around it, because there are a lot of, for one thing, just gay Catholics who are committed to living celibately in accord with what the church teaches. And that's true of, you know, straight people are supposed to keep sex within marriage, and it's supposed to be something that applies to everybody, not just gay Catholics. And so the idea that gay priests somehow are less good or therefore going to prey on children because they're gay, I think is really harmful and something that nobody should say or suggest. But I do also think, you know, if you have people going into the priesthood who are doing it for the wrong reasons, and if that's partly because they might be gay or, you know, same-sex attracted, and they think that going into the priesthood is going to solve that, and it's not something they're committed to, you know, living a celibate lifestyle as every priest should, who knows, you know, that might lead to this type of, you know, if they're looking at the priesthood the wrong way, you could have people who are treating children in this way. And it's not because they're gay, but I do think there probably is some, in some cases, there's a connection there that we should talk about, but that should never mean that we say that gay people can't be priests, because there are lots of faithful Catholics who are same-sex attracted who also are good and faithful and celibate priests. And I think it'd be really harmful to the church to suggest that that's not possible.
Exactly. Andrew, you have a question?
I was just gonna say, like, when it, you know, you've had a lot of outside criticism. I mean, from non-religious people like myself, and from, you know, people of other religious faiths like Kim. Like, how would you hope that this goes forward? And what maybe is kind of the thing that you would hope that people who are, like, questioning their Catholicism or even, like, looking at the Catholic Church and saying, like, how is this something that, you know, is... I mean, this is a big question. I understand that. But, like, Billy McMorris was from the Free Beacon was saying, like, he was like, you know, the Catholic Church has withstood, you know, 1,000 years of kind of, you know, this of not this kind of scandal, but just like it's withstood a lot of things. So that, you know, obviously, like, you know, you have people of faith like yourself are very strong Catholics. What would you, you know, kind of hope that people understand that are looking at it from the outside in, that, you know, not trying to, you know, obviously defend what's going on, but just kind of like that you would hope that people understand about Catholics when they are looking at these kind of these huge negative stories, you know, that are that do kind of like hurt the Catholic Church in the eyes of the world rather than the faithful, I guess, is what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot, it's totally understandable that people outside the church would be disgusted by this as people inside the church are. But one thing I've seen over the last couple of weeks that's been hurtful might be too strong, but just there's been a lot of commentary saying that Catholics are complicit in this evil, or that if Catholics don't take X, Y, and Z response, they must be okay with this type of thing happening in the church. I think that's just terrible, and I would really rather not see that, because it is our church first and foremost. And while people outside the church, of course, can be rightly upset by this and want action and, you know, offer their opinions about what ought to be done, which I appreciate and I'm glad people care about the church, people inside the church are more hurt by this than anybody, because we still believe, the majority of us believe that this faith is still 100% true, and it's about the teachings and the tradition of it. That's all true. And because there are evil people in the hierarchy covering this up, or, you know, bad priests committing these types of atrocious acts, that doesn't change the substance of our faith. And so for people within the church, I think it's really important to stay close to the sacraments and to stay close to other Catholics who still believe completely in what their church teaches, and question the hierarchy of the church, and question your parish, and make sure that this kind of thing isn't happening in your communities. But don't let that affect your faith. And then for people outside the church, try to understand that and understand why people are Catholic, and separate this type of horrific abuse from the practice of Catholicism as much as you can.
Yeah, one of the things that you know, and that Catholics are still, you know, I mean, with Pope Francis, like, you know, we have a ton of new things coming out, you know, the focus on global warming and things like that. But the thing that has always stayed true and that has brought especially a lot of conservatives, you know, and Catholics and, you know, conservatives and Catholics and conservatives or Catholics and the, you know, Republican side is the pro-life issue. Pope Francis still seems to be staunchly pro-life, and as are you. And so we had this new attempt in America, in the Senate at least, to defund Planned Parenthood again, which ultimately failed. Do you want to, Kim or Alexander, do you guys want to say exactly what happened with Rand Paul and his bill?
He had an amendment to the appropriations package on Thursday that was initially kind of stopped by he was saying it was stopped by the Republican leadership. They didn't want to push that forward because it was going to be, quote, a poison pill with the election coming up. But they ended up doing a vote on it, and it failed, of course, 45-48. And shockingly enough, Collins and Murkowski sided with the Democrats on this amendment. I know that that's completely shocking that they would be totally fine with funding Planned Parenthood. I can't stand them. But yeah, this amendment would have defunded Planned Parenthood. Obviously, it failed. It wasn't going to happen. And it wasn't anywhere close to the 60 vote threshold, which is frustrating. But I think it was Jim Swift of the Weekly Standard. He was talking about this on Twitter, how this was not the first time that Republicans have been kind of, you know, lackadaisical in their attempt to defund. And he even mentioned Rand Paul is kind of, you know, he is a little bit of some blame to take for. Like, he was against the Graham Cassidy bill. He helped kill that, and that would have, you know, done some – that addressed a Planned Parenthood and the funding. So I guess the frustration is we're told by so many candidates, even people, newcomers, incumbents and everything, well, vote for us. We'll, you know, we're going to address Planned Parenthood. But it's not really taken care of, and when the chance – comes to address it, people seem a little like, well, that's not as important as other things that we're mentioning. But so, I mean, I kind of went off the rails there when I was talking about it. But Alexander, what's your take on the, like, kind of the laziness of the GOP? I mean, I know that there's not a 60 vote, they're not going to get 60 votes in the Senate, but why for so long has the pro-life community been told that they're going to see it, you know, be addressed in Congress? And it's just not. I mean, how long do we have to listen to this?
Oh, I probably forever. I'm starting to believe it's just never going to happen. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's disappointing. It's frustrating. And I think I try to be hopeful and I try to expect that these leaders actually mean what they say, but I'm just getting more and more cynical. And I think it's pro-life people shouldn't be naive about this and shouldn't kid themselves into thinking that defunding Planned Parenthood or limiting abortion or things like this are actually a priority for the vast majority of Republicans. Mm-hmm. Because if it was, it would happen. You see the way that they treat things that are a priority and they get it done. Mitch McConnell is pushing judges through. And, you know, obviously there's a lower threshold for those judicial confirmation votes. And so it's a little bit different. But I think we've all seen the way that our politicians act when they care about getting something done. To the extent that they ever do once in a while. And that's not how they act about defunding Planned Parenthood. And so I think pro-lifers need to look at this very seriously and just accept the fact and take very seriously the fact that our leaders actually are not making this a priority. And when it comes down to it, they care much more about the optics of it. They'll once in a while, you know, have a vote here and there just so they can go home and say, look, I voted to defund Planned Parenthood and those terrible Democrats stood in the way again. I'd love to see, you know, Mike Pence, for example, on Capitol Hill lobbying Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski on this. Why are those conversations not taking place? And maybe you still don't get to 60 votes, but make it politically costly for people to vote against defunding Planned Parenthood. I've always said I'm probably being intensely idealistic, but I would like to see a senator or many senators on why Planned Parenthood should be defunded and why it's not bad for low-income women. Why is no one saying that? This is why we can't defund Planned Parenthood. You know, I apologize for going on a rant here, but it shouldn't be difficult. And the talking points that the left uses to defend Planned Parenthood need to be shot down over and over and over again until Democrats can't get away with voting to fund it anymore.
Right.
And no, I love that rant. Keep going.
Yeah. we always love guests that talk a lot. but Alexandra, what would you... Because I understand this, but when you talk about the fact that people, one of the constant refrains is that there's already a a law that says that you can't fund abortions. And then you bring up the fungibility aspect. And it's one of the most frustrating things to talk about with people that, you know, especially like pro-abortion people or people who, you know, a lot of people, you know, Kim and I have had guests on to specifically talk about Catholicism and abortion, actually, with Charles Camozzi. But, you know, people don't seem to realize that there is this thing called fungibility, which means that if you give dollars here, which Planned Parenthood, and do you just want to explain a little bit of why, you know, it's like conservatives and Republicans aren't picking on Planned Parenthood. That's the thing is that Planned Parenthood has this default position where they make millions of dollars a year in donations because it looks like we're picking on the big bad Planned Parenthood as this like boogeyman of abortion. And yet they do, you know, hundreds of thousands of abortions a year and they get tons of federal dollars.
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood performs over 300,000 abortions every year. That number has gone down slightly the last couple of years, but it's gone up a ton over the last couple of decades, especially under Cecile Richards' leadership. So they're the largest abortion provider in the country by a lot. 300,000, that's a third of the abortions in the country by the best numbers that we have. So this is a huge abortion corporation. This is not women's health care. The other things that they do are, you know, pale in comparison to abortion. So the idea that this is just your kind of local friendly neighborhood women's healthcare provider is ludicrous. And yet we hear this all the time. In terms of federal funding, Planned Parenthood gets about $500 million every year. And when people say that this doesn't go to abortion, they're right in one sense. So Planned Parenthood can't apply for Medicaid reimbursements for abortion procedures. So in that sense, that's how the Hyde Amendment restricts the funding. But Planned Parenthood does get $500 million from the federal government. And this is like saying, well, my dad doesn't pay for my rent, but he gives me $100 for my car payment. Okay, so then you have another $100 freed up elsewhere that you can use to pay for your rent, right? So your dad's not directly writing you a check that says rent in the bottom corner, but you are being aided in everything else that you do by the fact that you're getting $100 from your dad to pay off your car loan. Kind of a loose analogy. But anyway, that's the general idea. So when people say, well, it's not funding abortion, it is funding abortion because Planned Parenthood performs over 300,000 abortions every year, and they're getting $500 million from the federal government in order to just keep operating as an organization. So when people say this, I think a lot of the time it's just a talking point that Planned Parenthood and Democrats and left-wing activists throw around that people have bought hook, line, and sinker. And I think a lot of the time it's also being intentionally obtuse because people want to protect Planned Parenthood and they want to act like abortion's not being funded. But I don't see people on the right, you know, obviously they're big pro-life groups and writers like us articulating this, but I don't think politicians have really been well-versed in explaining this stuff in a way that makes sense to the average person. And I think polling shows that most Americans do not like taxpayer-funded abortion, but at the same time, most Americans want to keep funding Planned Parenthood. So that's kind of a bizarre disparity that needs to be dealt with and needs to be addressed and needs to be fixed, because most Americans just don't realize that funding Planned Parenthood equals funding abortion.
And I don't think that they realize, because, you know, if you shut down Planned Parenthood, there are no women's clinics or women's health care in the, you know, at all if you do that, right?
Women will literally die when the doors are shut.
What's the statistic? It's like there's three times as many women's clinics.
20 to 1.
Yeah, 20 to 1. Okay, so I was way off.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. The Charlotte Lozier Institute, and this is, I think, 3 years old, but they have a great map, and I know all of us have seen this, but it shows how Planned Parenthood is outnumbered 20 to 1 by comprehensive women's healthcare clinics that don't do abortion. I mean, yesterday, someone on Twitter, when I was talking about defunding Planned Parenthood, they're like, yes, I would love that, but only if we can have something put in place that also helps women. I was like, but it's already there. I mean, don't act like there's no care for women if Planned Parenthood is gone. That's just not true. And like you said, if we want to go against these talking points, we need to provide facts, because clearly people don't know the facts.
No, they really don't. When it comes to these other clinics, the vast majority of people have no idea that these exist. And the Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood are, in fact, efforts to redirect funding to these federally qualified healthcare centers, which there are over 13,000 across the country. And there's, I think, about 600 Planned Parenthood clinics. So the idea that if Planned Parenthood clinics, by the way, also, if we defund Planned Parenthood, let's note that we're not shutting down Planned Parenthood.
Exactly.
So this equation on the left that, you know, defunding Planned Parenthood equals it doesn't exist anymore is untrue. They get millions and millions, maybe even billions, I'm not sure the exact number, of donations every year. So they're not closing their doors, okay? They're just going to not have federal funding. They've obviously set up that equation so that people won't want to defund them. But even so, even if every Planned Parenthood in the country were to close, there would still be 13,000 federally qualified healthcare centers everywhere. They're everywhere, and they don't offer abortions. And they're obviously a place where low-income women can go and get more real healthcare. The procedures that Planned Parenthood provides are extremely limited. If you look at the numbers, it's all in their annual reports. They do basically no adoptions. They do basically no prenatal care. They're an abortion corporation. They do some STD testing. They do some cancer screening, but they do very little otherwise. And so the idea that it's going to be terrible for women if these places don't get federal funding anymore is just an absolute fiction peddled by the left to keep their federal funding.
Yeah, and we're heading
and
into...
Another...
Oh, sorry, Kim, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. We keep jumping all over each other. We're just so passionate about
this topic. We can't see each other. I always say that's the problem. We can't see each other. We don't have, like, the normal, like, facial cues of, like, oh, I'm jumping in here.
So true. But, yeah, another, like you were saying, they do very, like, limited medical procedures and tests and everything. And for so long, people said that, well, Planned Parenthood does mammograms. There's not a single mammography machine in any Planned Parenthood in the United States. And even when Cecile Richards was on Capitol Hill testifying, I mean, I know, I feel like she's not maybe directly addressed this head on in the past, but she certainly didn't, like, mind if people shared this lie. But when they asked her, like, head on at this hearing several years ago, she's like, no, there's no mammograms done at Planned Parenthood. But still, people think there are mammograms done at Planned Parenthood and that it's an essential part of women's healthcare. And like you said, it's absolutely not. And also, a lot of Planned Parenthoods are in urban centers. So if we're not saying that they prey upon the minorities and women who have, you know, lower financial capabilities, then we're not, like, even fighting. I mean, Rand Paul and other people can stand on the Senate floor and saying it's horrible, but if we're not, you know, sharing the truth, there's, I mean, what are we doing?
What's
up? Oh, that's right. Sorry, go ahead.
Nope, go ahead. I was just going to point out that women's clinics necessarily set themselves up, typically, especially pro-life ones, right across the street from Planned Parenthood locations. Just you know, anyway, so Zan, go ahead.
No, that's a great point. I'm glad that you brought that up, because there are actually I'm thinking of a chain called the Women's Care Center in particular, which is crisis pregnancy, which is a little bit different, of course, from these federally qualified clinics. But when they set up, they almost always choose a location as close as they possibly can to abortion clinics, whether that's Planned Parenthood or another one. And if you look at their statistics, it's fascinating. When they open in these cities next to abortion clinics, the abortion rate actually drops noticeably over a course of a couple years. And it's not because they're bullying women or, you know, in the streets trying to block the abortion clinic. It's because when women see that they have other options, they take those other options. And so I think the talking points that Planned Parenthood offers are convincing, because we don't offer the pro-life movement is not coherent, and its politicians have not learned to offer the best talking points for why women don't actually need abortion and why women will get better health care at places other than Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, and there's also, I will do a free commercial. There's also the facilities, the mobile facilities of Save the Storks, which is mobile ultrasound, you know, they do women's health mobily to get to places like Appalachia and other, like, underserved areas that aren't in urban centers, that are actually, they go into rural areas to provide services. So you have tons of pro-life options. But we do have the Kavanaugh hearings coming up, just to kind of wrap this up. But we do have the Kavanaugh hearings coming up, and this abortion issue is going to be, I mean, the Democrats are making this into being huge.
It's the issue. Yeah.
How do you see this going up as we've got a week and a half left before the Kavanaugh steering hearings start? Well, unless, you know, Democrats on the Judiciary Committee get their wish and get the hearing postponed. But I think Dianne Feinstein did an admirable job representing the Democrats, but I don't think it's going anywhere. But how do you see this, like, you know, this kind of S storm that we see coming up happening?
Well, I will say Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed. I'm just going to go out there on a limb and put that prediction out there. He's going to be confirmed, because, as I said a little while ago in this podcast, and we all agreed, when Mitch McConnell wants to get something done, he gets it done. Okay, he's going to get this guy confirmed. Again, the vote threshold is lower, but I think the hearings will probably feature some questions about Roe v. Wade. I think last week it was reported that in his meeting with Susan Collins, Kavanaugh said he agrees with Chief Justice John Roberts, that Roe is settled law. But as people, you know, Ramesh Pranur and others have pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean he wouldn't vote to overturn Roe or Casey.
Right.
Just rarely will comment on, in fact, never generally comment on how they would rule in particular cases. And settled law doesn't mean, you know, that we would vote to, that he wouldn't vote to overturn necessarily. It's just kind of a line that justices use, or judges use, rather, to articulate their view of precedent. So I'm not saying necessarily he would overturn Roe, but I think if it comes up, we can expect a similar answer from him during the hearings. But that, of course, will not stop from the left, as they already have begun doing, from making this kind of the huge sticking point of the confirmation. Women are going to die if he's confirmed. Roe is necessarily going to be overturned. Abortion will be illegal everywhere. All this kind of, you know, fear-mongering and scare tactics, and just preying upon the fact that most Americans don't understand Roe. Most Americans don't know what would happen if it was overturned. And so I think it's been really disgusting to see a lot of that. I expect it to continue through the hearings.
And I think one big thing, I mean, excellent answer, by the way. One big thing I think the pro-life community needs to remember, we put so much hope, and it's so easy to do this. We put so much hope in the legislative branch and the judicial branch. And if things change from there, then, oh man, things are going to change all across the country. And people, if abortion, there's more restrictions on it, or we have judges who are pro-life, then things are absolutely going to change. And while I completely support legislative changes and judges who would consider, you know, reconsider Roe or Casey, I think it's important for us to remember that we need the culture of life to, you know, change from the ground up. And like a trickle down effect is fantastic, but we need to, in our communities, you know, locally, we need to realize that women, there are women who are pregnant and they don't have the resources they believe that they, you know, need to, you know, have a child. They want options, and not every woman wants her child. I mean, that's the sad fact, and that's the reality. And until we help those in our community and sort of, you know, make pro-life issue a grassroots effort, really, then nothing's, you know, the culture of death is not going to change that much.
That's a great point. I'm really glad that you brought that up, because, again, overturning Roe is not going to change everything. But I do think there is an element in which having Roe and Casey overturned, or at least changed somewhat, will be helpful in creating that kind of culture. Because right now, I've noticed when one writes about or talks about abortion, a huge part of the response is, abortion is legal, get over yourself. You know, right. It's been legal since 1973, we don't have to talk about this. And so I think once that framework, you know, hopefully at some point soon, who knows, shifts, I think that forces the other side to actually address, what is abortion? Why is it okay to have this? And then we're actually having a conversation about the substance of what abortion is, and what that right is, and what the competing rights at stake are, which is a conversation we never have and absolutely need to be having. But I think at least at the kind of top level public opinion, public dialogue discussion about this, we don't really get to that because Roe is standing in the way.
Right.
But your point is well taken and a good one.
Yeah, I mean, we can't even get a 20-week abortion ban, you know, passed federally. It's always a little bit frustrating.
And we have some of the most permissive abortion laws in the world, and people still think we live in these, like, dark times. And, of course, the handmaids will, you know, walk around everywhere acting like, you know, they're living in such oppression. Come on.
No, abortion's legal through all 9 months of pregnancy. And I actually, this morning, saw somebody on Twitter reply to something that I had said, saying that abortion is illegal after 12 weeks in the U.S. I don't know where people get this information.
What?
It's just not true. I'd love if that were true, but it's just not.
What state is that? I've never heard of them.
I always, and I know I've mentioned, Kim's heard me say this a dozen times probably at this point, but, you know, I live less than a mile from British Columbia, and I always say, like, people always think of British Columbia as being this very, like, you know, permissive, hippie kind of, you know, very liberal culture. You cannot have an abortion, or you cannot find out the gender of your child until after the abortion limit has been reached, because there is one, and you can't find out from your ultrasound tech. You have to find out, the ultrasound tech has to send it to your prenatal care doctor, and they decide whether you are fit to find out. So, you know, it's like that always kind of like astonishes people when I say that, like, that's British Columbia, Canada, you know, and there isn't a limit on when, how late you can have an abortion. That's not true here. Yeah. Well, Zan, thank you so much for coming on and talking about kind
such
of
a,
like,
fantastic guest.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
And where can everybody find your stuff and follow you and see what you're doing?
So my writing is all at National Review Online. I'm on Twitter at Zan_DeSanctis, XAN _DeSanctis, my last name. And then I also co-host a podcast of my own with David French called Ordered Liberty. And we talk a lot about, you know, cultural issues and abortion from time to time. So hop on over there if you're interested in hearing us.
Yeah, I will definitely, I'm a podcast addict, so I will definitely be, I didn't even know about that one, so I will go and look that one up. But thank you so much for being on again, and have a great weekend.
Yep, you too.
Bye. Well, that was truly delightful, and I loved having Alexandra on to talk about, you know, it was kind of like stank that it was such heavy topics, but yeah, she was great.
No, it was good. Yeah. And I mean, National Review is one of, I think, the last beacons of conservatism kind of, I mean, except places that, you know, except what we say when we write, but I just appreciate National Review and the positions they take. And Alexandra is such a voice for the innocent, whether they're like, you know, in the church, and she's talking about Catholicism, or the pro-life issue and the unborn. So I really appreciated having her on.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, when she said that she was 23, I was like, she's 23. Like, that is awesome. Like, I mean, it's amazing that she's, you know, she's such a talented writer and working with National Review, and so loquacious and eloquent in how she talks and speaks. I was sitting there kind of thinking, like, I'm a fast talker. You're a fast talker. Alexandra's a fast talker. I was like, oh gosh. I was like, people are gonna, we're speeding right through this podcast. It's kind of a shorter one this time, because we're all fast talkers, so maybe this is the one time, listener, where you don't speed your podcast up to 1.25, you actually slow it down so that you can actually take in what we're saying. But on a lighter note, I do have a silly story. PETA, our other favorite you know, PETA got animal crackers to take the animals out of cages on their boxes. But they also are now going after, they put up a huge billboard in one of the official crab capital of the world, Baltimore in Maryland. They have put up, I'm me, not meat, and put a blue crab on this big, huge billboard sign. And it's the locals are, you know, as you would expect, you know, scoffing and mocking and mild, not outraged, but just kind of, you know, like rolling their eyes at this. I saw one response that I actually wrote about at Red State, this issue, and it's just kind of something silly. But
I don't know if it was on the billboard or in their just general campaign, but part of what they're saying in, you know, terms of this campaign is that this lobster has feelings.
Yes, yes.
And can experience pain. And, you know, I mean, put the pain aspect aside. I mean, obviously, I don't think that animals that we eat should, you know, be tortured before they're, you know, taken care of course. Mm-hmm. But as far as feelings, we're going to say a lobster has feelings. Like, that's what we're going with. Like, that's why. It's amazing to me. But of course, as we've talked about, I mean, the unborn, that doesn't matter because they're, you know, they're parasites in a woman's body. But a lobster has feelings, Andrea.
Yeah.
Andrea, I can't handle that.
I know. It's been a lifelong thing. And Adam Kroll, which I, like I mentioned, I'm a podcast addict. And so I've listened to Adam Kroll for almost 10 years now. But he always brings up the Andrea thing as the like annoying person who's like, my name is Andrea. I'm like, so I try not to do it. But at the same time, it's like, that's not my name. So I totally get Alexandra's issues with being called Alexandria.
I have a little aside. Oh, from sure. the PETA campaign is, you know, in the effort to keep people from eating actual, you know, meat, I saw this, I think it was on Facebook this week, that by the end of the year, there may probably be lab-grown meat available for people to eat. And vegans are pushing this, you know, so animals won't have to be slaughtered. But lab-grown meat sounds like the worst thing ever.
And you're not even a meat fan, but and so you're a bad critic.
Love meat.
You're a bad critic. Well, see, that's why I always say my fiance is the worst person to like judge people or judge pizza toppings, because his favorite pizza is cheese pizza. I'm like, you don't get to. I'm like, you don't get to judge other types of pizza when your favorite pizza is cheese pizza.
That's just cheese on top of bread.
If I think that my favorite pizza is, you know, if I'm fine with a Hawaiian pizza or I want a supreme pizza, I get to say that. You don't get to, I get to judge the toppings. You don't, because you like cheese pizza best. But what was I going to say? Oh, I always say to all these people, you know, I will stop eating meat if you will be the person that goes around and kills all the cattle animals, all the livestock, all the chickens. Somebody has to kill those animals because they will then starve to death. Do you know how much it costs to feed one cow for a lifetime?
Right.
Thousands upon thousands of dollars. People will not feed livestock. They won't feed these animals. They won't take care of them. Why should they if they're not worth anything? And if you're just raising all these cows as pets and all these chickens as pets, you're going to have to slaughter millions, if not billions of animals. You will.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be the one to do it because I'm fine eating them and keeping it being an economy of, you know, meat processors and farmers. And, you know, I do believe in ethical farming, you know, that's something that, you know, we've kind of, because of government and anything else, people moving away from the family farm. I grew up on a family farm. And we did not, you know, the animals are animals. I'm sorry. Cows are freaking dumb. And they, you know, even when they go to feed at the manger, they will whack their heads harder than you. You'd probably break an arm and they will whack their heads on the manger, you know, trying to get into the, and not because their head can't fit. They're just that dumb. You know, so it's like, if you sit there and tell me that, you know, it's like, I'm sorry. Like if you feel something through leather, does it hurt? No. Okay. Cows are wearing leather constantly. It's just, you know, my grandmother. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I did not mean to interrupt you, but I was just going to say, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, which I'm pretty sure he will be, and if he will bring about the death of the entire population, then maybe I'm ready for it. Because if lab grown meat is all we have to look forward to, then what's the point?
Yeah. Do you eat tofu then? How do you get your protein?
No, I don't eat tofu. No, I eat meat. People don't think I eat meat. I like burgers, but they have to be well done. No pink. Pink is disgusting. I cannot handle that. I like tacos, okay? And I eat chicken pretty regularly.
Oh, okay.
Now,
okay.
I feel like I'm going to vomit when I'm preparing meat, and I wear gloves, and I have to, like, keep the bile down. I'm sorry, people. But I have to, like, physically work through preparing the meat. But I end up eating the meat. I just don't really like steak or ham or turkey or large chunks of anything. So.
Yes. Oh, my God. See, I eat anything. I really, really will. The only thing I won't eat, oddly enough, is a banana. I won't do
what?
It. Yeah. It's disgusting.
They don't have feelings. You should go get it.
How do you know, Kim? All right. Well, thank you so much. This is devolved into a big joke. But anyway, so thank you so much to Alexandra DeSantis. Definitely read her stuff over at National Review. She's doing amazing stuff over there for a 23-year-old. I'm so jealous. But Kim, where can everybody find you if they're not following you already?
Well, you can find me at Southern Keeks on Twitter, KEEKS. You can find me at Red State and Washington Examiner.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrea and Ruth. And you can find me on Facebook at Andrea Ruth Page or facebook.com/AndreaRuthPage and at Red State. And definitely go and subscribe and review our podcast, please.
Please.
And we will see you next time on another episode of The Right Side. Bye.